Good morning.
Good morning, ma'am. Good morning, your honors.
Good morning.
The clerk informed me that the curtain call is up a little faster, which is perfectly okay.
Good, we feel the same.
Yes, ma'am.
We're very happy, though, to give both of you your full amount of time. The other argument didn't require it. Take a moment to get ready and let us know when you are.
Thank you, your honor. I appreciate that. Morning, Aaron, by the way. I'm ready to get underway. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
May it please the court and counsel, the Minnesota Court of Appeals should reverse and remand the decision of the district court for further proceedings, including the determination of declaratory, equitable, and other mandamus relief under the Data Practices Act, and to set the matter for trial by jury in accordance with Minnesota Constitution Article 1, Section 4, and Minnesota Statute Section 13.08, Subdivision 1.
Could you please note your appearance for our audible record that we are making?
Thank you, Your Honor. This is Peter Nikitas. I am the attorney for the appellant and plaintiff, Kevin Karsgens, who appears before the court today. Your Honor, as to this is a Data Practices Act case. The important thing to remember about the Data Practices Act, as the legislature wrote it in 1974 and Governor Anderson signed it, and which has had some significant additions, but as to the principle that violations the Act defines separately from the remedies that it defines, that part of the Act remains unchanged. No doubt remains after the briefing that the Commissioner of Human Services, by vicarious liability and his responsibility or responsible of authority, caused the unlawful dissemination of private data on Mr. Karsgens to individuals who had no need to know and for whom Mr. Karsgens did not provide written informed consent as to the dissemination of these data to third parties. The two data, as the court is are aware, are the quarterly treatment record, which wound up in a fellow patient client's hands, a Mr. Lottie, by the agency of Mr. Will Robinson, who is an employee of the Department of Human Services, on September 22nd of 2016. And the second government data was the treatment report on November 29th of 2016 that wound up in another patient client's hands, Mr. Watkins, and through the agency of a Carolyn Rivers, an employee of the MSOP.
This now, goes more to your claim for exemplary damages, Mr. Nikitas, but are you claiming that these disclosures were willful?
Yes, he has pleaded that, and we are because there's yes, Your Honor, that's a short answer. It's okay. Willful because there are multiple violations that two or more, and certainly, Your Honor, we can bring to the jury's attention other instances under similar circumstances so that a jury can weigh the facts as to whether it merits exemplary relief, which the legislature has capped at $15,000. And that's a test that the jury decides.
Mr. Nikitas, would you agree your client did not follow the proper procedure by separate motion for the exemplary / punitive damages?
Judge Slider, thank you for your question. The answer is he proceeded properly. When you have a statutory cause of action that explicitly prescribes exemplary relief or punitive relief or something above and beyond compensatory or back pay or front pay, the two-step involving 549.191 and 549.20 doesn't come into play. I do concede, Your Honor, that the standard for proving up exemplary damages is the standard that 549.20 lays out for all punitive damages. If you had a claim under the Minnesota Human Rights Act where punitive damages are allowed, the plaintiff would have to prove it up by the standard of 549.20, even though she or he would not have to bring a separate motion. And the same applies to the Data Practices Act. And just getting to the point of the Act prescribes what adds up to a violation and prefaces that with the definitions of private and public data and also the obligations and identification of responsible authorities. We have a case where the quarterly treatment record and a treatment statement were private government data on Mr. Karstens by the plain words of the statute and by the commissioner's own directives, 149.5100 and 135.5300, which make these records private government data. And by reference, they're also personal identifying information medical records under the Medical Health Records Act, which appears at 144.291 through .298. And as to informed consent was lacking. What does informed consent require? That's an important phrase in our law. It appears in all sorts of contexts, professional responsibility, medical negligence, and it certainly appears in the Data Practices Act. The question that one would ask, does it have to be in writing? The answer is yes. Look at the plain words of 13.05 subdivision 4. You're talking about informed consent for the first time in a statute. Another case that I found, Ponticus against KMS Investments. That was not in the briefing, but it's important as to informed consent. And that's at 331 Northwest 2nd, 907, 914, note 11, which is a Minnesota Supreme Court case from 1983. And most importantly, and probably the easiest way to get to the back of the math book, as we used to have in school, Minnesota Rule 1205.1400, subpart 3 and subpart 4B, tells us what informed consent requires. Okay, subpart 3 requires a demonstration of the mental capacity and appreciation for the consequences for this dissemination of private government data. You've got to know what you're doing. You have to have the brains to know what you're doing, and you got to know what you're actually doing. And then under subpart 4B, it says, all informed consents shall be given in writing. And that's 1205.1400, subpart 4B. Okay. We don't have any written informed consent to authorize the dissemination of Mr. Karstens' quarterly treatment report to Mr. Lottie or the treatment report to Mr. Watkins. And the commissioner did provide in discovery documentation of Mr. Robinson's report as to the quarterly treatment report. And that was at MSOP document 00001, exhibits A through C. Now, the critical issue, once we've established a violation, is what are the remedies? And Mr. Karstens is certainly pleading for declaratory relief, which is available whenever there is a case in controversy between two parties, and it's appropriate to say where somebody stands and where the other party stands. That's under 1308 subdivision 2. 13.08 subdivision 2 also enshrines the availability of declaratory relief to prevent any violations of the Act in the future or to enjoin violations that are going on. Now, the commissioner made arguments that equitable relief has to have a predicate of irreparable harm. Okay, that's not what the legislature put in the statute. A demonstration that violations are going on and the ability for the court to stop the violations now and to stop them going on in the future is all that the legislature needs for the statute. That's what the legislature told the courts to do. You can impose equitable relief to enjoin violations. And we have a published Court of Appeals decision. This is the Edina School Board, School Board case from 1997, and I think the site is 562 Northwest 2nd 306, and particularly page 311. And the court recognized that the equitable remedies under that clause are plenary. You can do all sorts of things to stop violations of the act, not a precondition of irreparable harm. For what it's worth, that was a case that former Governor Pawlenty argued before the Court of Appeals himself, for what it's worth. Okay. Now, we saw a lot of arguments, good arguments, made on both sides as to the threshold for compensatory damages. This is the place where the district court erred by saying if you don't have you don't have any damages, you don't have a violation. Well, the plain words of the statute don't say that. The Eighth Circuit in the case Johnson against Carroll involving Data Practices Act violations by the city of Minneapolis along with excessive force by a police officer said no. You've got to look at all the remedies separately from the violation. Just because you don't have damages, that's not the end of the story. In this particular case, the Minnesota Supreme Court has told us what the trier of fact, the jury, should look at when it comes to damages and how much of a quantum of evidence will get you to the jury. And that is the Navarre case. That's certainly an important case to the commissioner. It's been a very important case since 2002. And the important thing to recognize there is to read the entire decision, particularly on pages 30 and 31. In that particular case, we had an unauthorized disclosure of private government data about a teacher that sounded like common law defamation at the same time. How much time do I have? Do I have 5 minutes afterwards?
You have 5 minutes for rebuttal. You have 2 minutes and
good.
36.
Okay, that's fine, Your Honor. I'm okay. So what happened in that case? They tried the case. She got a significant verdict. The Court of Appeals reversed in part, took it up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, "Here's how you're going to try the case." The district court erred in keeping out all the psychological records the school district sought to introduce to negate any claim for compensatory damages. The Supreme Court also said, you've got the plaintiff, Ms. Navarre, you got her father talking about the emotional distress and all of this. She doesn't have a doctor. She doesn't have a psychologist. She doesn't have anybody else. But that's good enough to put the question of damages, any damages, as the plain words of the statute prescribes, in front of the jury. And I make a particular note that the district court set aside the citation to a U.S. district court case, Shkirat against U.S. Airways. That's 515 F sup 2nd 984, particularly page 998. That was a decision by Judge Montgomery. And this was a plaintiff claiming that the Metropolitan Airports Commission in part violated his Data Practices Act rights by putting his name and his Social Security number out on the internet and caused a lot of emotional distress that Mr. Carson described, okay? I'll get to that in a second. And the U.S. Supreme Court, in a case, Commissioner of Internal Revenue, against the estate of Bosch back in 1967 said that when a district court, U.S. district court, is ruling on an issue where the law may not be entirely clear, you got to do what the state Supreme Court would have done. Well, Judge Montgomery actually quoted the entirety of pages 30 and 31 from Navar and allowed that claim to, under the Data Practices Act, to proceed. And it was an error for Judge Castro not to pay attention to that or to the entirety of Navar. Now, the commissioner has shown that Mr. Kojdjian's certainly put his record out into public view in the class action challenging the existence of the MSOP. However, the violations that we're talking about happened after that testimony, and he has a statutory right under the Data Practices Act, and he has a right as a patient client under the commissioner's own directives to the privacy of this government data. And he has a right to make his pitch, you know, to the jury. They can claim.
His argument is this disclosure, I know your time has expired, but
that's all right.
Just very briefly, this disclosure perhaps set him up for identity theft. When, of course, respondent's argument is whether or not it occurred afterward, the very same information and more was available through all these other means publicly.
The statute and the directive is very clear as to what equals a violation. And whether his previous testimony adds up to anything, the jury gets to decide, Your Honor, whether it's a lot or whether it's a little. And they also get to decide what the remedy would be. And certainly the district court, I could talk about what kind of equitable remedies the district court did not consider.
You'd like to do that on rebuttal?
I will do that, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nikitas.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Aaron Winter. I'm an assistant attorney general here on behalf of the respondent. First, I just want to, I guess, play off of some things that Mr. Nikita said to clarify what the particular appeal is actually about. There is a dispute on the facts about whether or not an MSOP employee was responsible for either one of the two disclosures that's at issue in this case, and that's not before the court because I brought the summary judgment motion on the damages issue. We think that the defendant, if it went to trial, would prove that they're not responsible for the actual disclosure, but acknowledging that that's a jury question, that wasn't part of the summary judgment briefing. Similarly, what also wasn't part of the summary judgment briefing is any argument that Mr. Karshans had, you know, agreed to disclosure of either of these documents. So those things just really aren't a part of the appeal, and what is part of the appeal is an issue that I'll echo the prior couple of arguments and say that it's pretty simple, which is there has to be some kind of evidence of damage under either the MHRA or the MGDPA. What they say is MGDPA says that the responsible authority, if there's a disclosure, is responsible for any damage that is caused as a result, or is liable for damages that are caused as a result, any damage. And the MHRA says, similar thing, liable for compensatory damages. In the absence of damage, the plain language of those statutes mean there is no liability on behalf of the respondent. And Mr. Nikitas argued to the district court and is fond of saying, and I don't blame him, asserting that the jury gets to decide all these questions. The jury doesn't get to decide everything. There are well-established standards that are applicable to summary judgment, applicable to directed verdict, that then take into account the legal rules that set forth a threshold of evidence that's required in order to get to the jury. And there's a very important one that's at issue here, which is the one stated at Navar in the case of statutory causes of action that deal with emotional distress damages. And what Navar holds, is in terms of the rule of law that's at issue there, is it reversed the Court of Appeals holding that statutory causes of action for emotional distress didn't require severe emotional distress. In other words, the holding is that they do require severe emotional distress, and then it reiterated a prior statement from the Supreme Court that in addition to the severity, the claimed emotional distress damages have to occur under circumstances indicating their genuineness. So it's the trial court's call as to whether or not the facts in the record reach that threshold. If they do, if a reasonable jury under the directed verdict standard could find that there are severe damages and that's sufficiently genuine, then it absolutely goes to the jury. But if they couldn't find that in the trial court's judgment, that is something that does not go to the jury, and that's something that, of course, can be reviewed by the Court of Appeals. So what's at issue here is whether there is any evidence of severe emotional distress or genuine emotional distress, and really there's been no argument to the contrary. There's a concession in the brief that Mr. Carson's claim damages are not severe, and really the argument in response has otherwise just been that Navarre doesn't say what it plainly says. Now, it's true that the result of Navarre is that the claim in that case should have gone to the jury because it did have sufficient indicators of genuineness. But in that case, there was this kind of, it was frankly this rather bizarre campaign by members of a school to sort of keep publicly saying negative things about one of its teachers. So it was very, very clear in that case that there were circumstances sufficiently indicating the genuineness of the emotional distress that she claimed and the severity thereof. And for the reasons described in the brief, I don't know if it would be worth the time to go through them all, but they're outlined in the brief that not only has Mr. Carson's failed to put forward anything affirmative that shows that his emotional distress was severe or genuine, there are a lot of circumstances, in fact, all the facts indicate affirmatively that it is not, which is frankly not even the defendant's burden to put before the trial court anything affirmatively saying that it isn't genuine, but there was a lot of evidence to that effect here. The fact that all of the same information was put publicly at issue in other contexts by Mr. Carson's, the fact that he agreed to essentially a redisclosure of the November 2016 information to Mr. Hawkins, the exact same disclosure, the fact that all of these people who briefly received these documents said they didn't internalize any of the private information contained therein, and they essentially received the document and said, oh, this isn't mine, and gave it back to Mr. Carson's. So all that evidence supports the dismissal of the claim for damages. Again, there's no nominal damages here. Nominal damages are when there isn't some sort of economically measurable damage, but there is a damage. So I think that counsel's example in his brief was of a trespass where somebody admittedly trespasses, that admittedly constitutes the elements of the tort of trespass, but perhaps there were not economically measurable damages. Then you can get a dollar in nominal damages, perhaps. The way that the statute is written, there are no nominal damages. It's compensatory damages or any damages. The issue here, no nominal damages, there's no damage. There is no liability under the plain language of the statute. That's what that says. So we've also heard some arguments, aside from the damages type relief that Mr. Carson's was requesting, we've heard some arguments about equitable relief. So a few comments about that. With respect to injunctive relief, there's been some, rather, frankly, citationless discussion of just sort of the general possibility that there are other MGDPA violations that may have occurred at the MSOP facility and that somehow that requires some kind of injunction on Mr. Carson's behalf. Aside from the obvious issues of a complete lack of proof on that, lack of standing by Mr. Carson's, focusing on Mr. Carson's claims, the reason he can't have an injunction in this case is because there's nothing to enjoin. There were two discrete disclosures. They're alleged to be mistakes, or maybe they're alleged to be willful or whatever, but they're discrete. There's just nothing to enjoin. No one is proposing to do anything in the future that would violate the law, and to the extent that Mr. Carson's is arguing, you know, they need to be enjoined to not violate the MGDPA. Well, that's what statutes are for. The MGDPA already enjoins them to follow the MGDPA, and if they don't, it has particular remedies that are available sometimes. And that's illustrated by the particular language of the MGDPA, where it talks about an injunction. What it says an injunction can be used for under that statute is when there is the use or employment by any person of a practice which violates this chapter. So that's just not the claim here, and to the extent that's trying to become the claim on appeal, there's no evidence that there's any use or practice. It's a mistake, or it's a discrete willful violation, according to counsel. Now, with declaratory judgment, the purpose of declaratory judgment is not to have some kind of decision on a factual issue that otherwise has no relief-related result. So here, there's no disagreement about the fact that if Mr. Carson's is right that an MSOP employee gave somebody accidentally or intentionally gave somebody a protected document, there's no disagreement that as a matter of law that would be prohibited by the MGDPA. the declaratory judgment that Mr. Carson seems to be requesting is, well, even if I have no damages under the statute, I should still be able to go to trial just for a declaratory judgment about whether this particular fact happened. And I've cited in the brief, that's just not what declaratory judgment is for. It's for a case or controversy, an actual live disagreement about the meaning of a statute. And what that says is there has to be a disagreement about the rights, status, and other legal relations between the parties. And I also cited in the brief some case law stating very specifically that factual disagreements are not sufficient. I also note in the brief, and I would just renew that and note that I still make the argument that the particular assertion that a trial about entitlement to a declaratory judgment alone, that was not made below in front of Judge Castro. No argument was made in front of Judge Castro by Mr. Carson to say, well, even if you find that he doesn't have any damage or sufficient damage to proceed to a jury on that question, we should still proceed to a jury about whether a declaratory judgment on this fact issue is appropriate. That argument wasn't made. So that is waived in defendant's view. With respect to punitive or exemplary damages, here's the statute. It says, upon commencement of a civil action, so apparently any civil action, the complaint must not seek punitive damages. And then it sets forth a procedure for amending to seek punitive damages. That didn't happen here. Aside from that, the only claim below was that any disclosure was, the way Mr. Carson said it, was willfully negligent. In other words, they should have done a better job. It was very negligent, or negligent in a way that made him unusually angry or something like that. But there isn't any evidence of willfulness in the record whatsoever. So that would be the reasons why Judge Castro's decision on punitive or exemplary damages is also appropriate. Overall, just one final comment on the declaratory judgment piece, and then I'll be done. Overall, I think what Mr. Carson's vision of an MGDPA case is that even if for any alleged MGDPA violation where somebody was able to see a piece of your information, even if it's conceded that there's absolutely no damages whatsoever, that did no harm to you at all, that would somehow in every case at the plaintiff's option result in a litigation all the way through trial, if that's what he wants to do, because in his view, a declaratory judgment would be available in any conceivable situation in which that's alleged. And that's not what the law is in declaratory judgment. That's not consistent with either the plain language of the statute in terms of requiring any damage for liability, or frankly, many cases by this court in holding that these kind of, actually specifically for MSOP clients, these kind of emotional distress damages simply are not sufficient to meet the Navarre test and are not sufficient for MGDPA or MHRA liability. And though I would note for the court, there's an unpublished case that came out recently that's very pertinent to this point. It's called Rhodes versus Lori, and the citation is 2019 Westlaw 100-6804. And that actually dismisses very similar claims to the ones that are at issue in this case on a Rule 12, so not even getting to summary judgment. Unless there are any other questions.
Thank you,
Your
Mr.
Honors.
Winter.
I would ask that the court affirm the judgment of the district court in dismissing the case. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal, Mr. Nikitas.
Thank you, Your Honor. Okay. First things first. As to the citation of unpublished decisions, the legislature and the Supreme Court in the Vlahos case said that they're just worthless.
Well, they're persuasive. They're not precedential.
They're not precedential, not to be relied on. The best thing that somebody could do is to look at the published decisions that the unpublished decisions rest on and try to lift them up. Other than that, got to set them aside. Now, as far as addressing the availability of declaratory and injunctive relief, I will respectfully direct the court to pages 23 and 24 of the transcript of the hearing before Judge Castro, and there was a discussion as to the availability of declaratory and injunctive relief. So it's not a brand new issue on appeal. It was clearly prayed for in Mr. Carson's pleading, and it was certainly addressed at oral argument before Judge Castro. Now, as I said earlier, Your Honor, going to talk briefly about the Navarre case and about remedies. First, remedies, okay? I promised I would talk about that. Now, what we have here are unlawful or unauthorized disseminations of private government data, medical records about patient clients. How can that be enjoined and how can it be controlled? Much of these unlawful disseminations go through the mail system. How do you keep people from getting somebody else's mail? Same way that somebody checks out a library book from the library. Show your library card. Show your ID. You know, make sure that mail isn't just distributed in a box and left for patient clients to pick up at their leisure. Client's got mail, got to bring his ID or her ID and say, okay, here's your mail, nobody else's. That's very simple. Now, Navarre is very important to this case, and I direct the court's attention to the principal brief at page 14, because the principal brief at page 14 has the entire material quote from Navarre, okay? Now, the Supreme Court did recognize, and I did underline, while this evidence, Navarre's evidence, was conclusory and not substantiated by any medical testimony, we affirm the Court of Appeals and hold that the evidence was sufficient to allow respondents, that was Navarre's case, emotional damage claim to be submitted to the jury. And then they talked about the error that the district court made in keeping the psychological evidence out. Now, when it comes to any damages, any is a word that has universal application. By its definition, that would also include nominal damages. And we have made arguments citing to the common law case, and that was the Syme against Jensen, where a trespass that wasn't very economically damaging, but the district court instructed the jury, put a dollar down for nominal damages. The state Supreme Court also had a case on the Minnesota Fair Labor Standards Act, which we have cited below. That was Milner against Farmers Insurance Exchange. That was at 748 Northwest 2nd, 802. That was a case where there was a violation by the failure to keep proper records, as the Minnesota FILSA prescribed. There was no award of back pay, compensatory damages, or anything the like, but the Supreme Court said that in this certain case, it was proper to award nominal damages, and that they could figure, the district court was perfectly well equipped to figure out what a reasonable attorney fee would be under the Supreme Court's precedence of Head against Paulson and Rule of General Practice 119.01 to 0.04, because the results were part of the lodestar. And last night I made a Rule 128.05 letter that cited a recent decision by the Minnesota Supreme Court that reaffirmed the lodestar as the way to calculate. So nominal damages are clearly in play under the Data Practices Act, or in its plain words, and emotional distress is triable, as Professor Steenson showed in his law review article, which the commissioner didn't cite, and it's certainly triable here. And we certainly have a violation, and the plain words of the statute are telling us: look at the violation first, then look at the damages, look at the remedies separately. And I see that my time is up. The Court of Appeals should reverse and remand this matter for a trial on damages and the fashioning of appropriate relief. Thank you, Your Honors, for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Nikitas. Thank you, Mr. Winter. Case has been submitted. That's the last case for our oral consideration. We have other non-oral cases on the calendar as well today, and so the court is in recess.